There's so much health advice out there, lots of different voices and opinions, but who can you trust? Trust the experts, the world's brightest medical minds, our very own Cleveland Clinic experts. We ask them tough, intimate health questions so you get the answers you need. This is the Health Essentials Podcast, brought to you by Cleveland Clinic and Cleveland Clinic Children's. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician.
Hi, and thanks for joining us for this episode of the Health Essentials Podcast. My name is Molly Schrodes, and I'll be your host. Today, we're talking about congenital heart defects and the impact they can have on a child's life. We're here with Dr. Bradley Marino, a pediatric cardiologist. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Molly. How are you?
Great. So starting off, can you tell us a little bit about the types of patients that you see?
So we're very fortunate here at Cleveland Clinic Children's to see really the entire breadth and depth of patients with congenital heart disease. Some of those patients have very mild congenital heart defects where they don't need any intervention or care other than just seeing a pediatric cardiologist intermittently over the course of their childhood, adolescence, into adulthood, to children that literally need emergency life-saving surgeries or cardiac catheterizations in the first 30 days of life so that they can survive.
So can you tell us, when you hear the phrase congenital heart defect, what does that exactly mean, and how much should a parent worry when they hear that?
That's a great question, Molly. And I think sometimes people get confused by what congenital heart disease means. Simply put, the heart is meant to form in a specific way. And we know what normal looks like in terms of how the chambers, the valves, and the vessels all come together to make your heart. In some children, sometimes it's how the chambers are set up between the atria, which are the filling chambers, and the ventricles, the pumping chambers. Sometimes it's the actual valves between those chambers, the tricuspid valve on the right side of the heart, and the mitral valve on the left side of the heart. Sometimes it's the vessels that come out of the right ventricle, the pulmonary artery, or out of the left ventricle, the aorta, that is abnormal. Sometimes it's a multitude of issues that encompass both the chambers, the valves, and the vessels. So, you know, each type of congenital heart defect or congenital heart disease is different. And we as pediatric cardiologists and pediatric cardiac surgeons look at every single patient as an individual, identify what the differences are in that child's heart structurally compared to a normal heart. And then we can sit with parents and we can explain to them exactly what that structural difference is, and then what we might do to make sure that child does well and again, survives and thrives.
Gotcha. Great. So what are a few of the most common heart defects that you might see in children?
So most common ones are actually fairly simple defects. So there's something called a patent ductus arteriosus, which all of us have in utero when we're in our mother's wombs, that sometimes instead of closing at birth stays open. Another very common one is something called an atrial septal defect, which is a hole between the two filling chambers, the right atrium and the left atrium. Another very common one is called a ventricular septal defect, which is a hole between the two pumping chambers, the right ventricle and the left ventricle. Some of those common, more complex structural defects, the most common blue baby congenital heart defect is tetralogy of Fallot, in which there's a combination of both the hole between the right ventricle and left ventricle and a problem with the pulmonary valve. There are other defects that are very common, like transposition of the great arteries, where the actual aorta, which comes out of the left ventricle, and the pulmonary artery, which comes out of the right ventricle, actually switched when the heart is created, and that requires surgery at birth. And then there's an entire broad group of congenital heart defects called single ventricle congenital heart defects, where instead of having two pumping chambers, the children are only born with one pumping chamber, and then we have to do some fairly complex surgery multiple times during the first year of life to create a structure in that heart that the child can survive and thrive into adulthood.
Perfect. So, Dr. Marino, can you tell me a little bit about why these defects happen? I mean, I know there's probably a different answer for different conditions, but kind of what's going on that makes this happen?
So for the vast majority of congenital heart defects, we actually don't have currently a specific genetic cause as to why they occur. But there are over 1,000 genetic abnormalities right now that are associated with structurally different hearts or congenital heart defects. We're learning every year about more and more genetically based congenital heart defects. And I think in 20 years, the vast majority of the congenital heart defects that we see will likely be from a genetic basis. Now, there are some congenital heart defects that actually result from exposure to babies of specific medications in utero in their mother's wombs. There are other congenital heart defects that may result from exposures, environmental exposures that the mother takes into her body that then end up being transmitted to the fetus. We know that there are certain types of nutritional and vitamin deficiencies that can result in not necessarily congenital heart defects, but specifically in other malformations in the body, like folate, if you don't take folate and having neural tube defects. So we're constantly learning about how the environment in which pregnant women and babies live and the medications or drugs that mothers may take and the genetic basis of congenital heart disease that is driving the number of children with congenital heart disease. So I think the important thing to know is that there's a specific rate of congenital heart disease in our population. And it's pretty consistent right now, really has not gone up over time, it's not gone down over time. So we continue to learn what the causes are of congenital heart disease, but the amount of congenital heart disease in our general population is pretty stable. I think the other thing that's really important that we talk about is that the most common birth defect in human beings is congenital heart disease. Very few people actually know that, that a structural abnormal heart is the most common birth defect in all of our human species. So most people don't know that many of the people that they work with, that they're friends with, in their families, that they have congenital heart disease. You know, and sometimes it's discovered in utero during a fetal ultrasound, sometimes it's discovered after birth, sometimes it's not discovered until childhood, even adulthood, that people have these congenital heart defects, but it's the most common birth defect that we see.
And once this defect is found, what's kind of the next step? Is there often immediate action taken, or is it a waiting game?
It really depends. I think the important thing is that over the last decade to 15 years, in most large cities that have major medical centers with birthing hospitals, the majority of babies with complex congenital heart disease are now being discovered in utero when these babies are in their mother's wombs. That's very, very different than it was 20 to 25 years ago. So the whole field of fetal ultrasound, of fetal echocardiography has really exploded. And now throughout the United States, there are very, very talented imagers that can now look at a fetus in utero in the mother's womb and actually identify that congenital heart defect before the child's born. This is critically important because if a child has a very complex congenital heart defect, we can then have that mother actually deliver at the hospital that the child's actually going to be cared for, which in a lot of times can either save that baby's life or minimize a transfer from an outlying hospital to that medical center that can take care of that baby, which could pose that baby a significant risk. So if you're a mother or father that finds out in utero that your child has a congenital heart defect, there's often a conversation that will happen with the obstetrician, a neonatologist, and a cardiologist, sometimes at what's called a fetal care center, at some of the major medical institutions nationally, Cleveland Clinic being one of them, that you will get a full briefing on what the child's congenital heart defect is, what's going to happen at the time of birth with the birth plan, and then what your child may require in those first 30 days of life to make sure that they survive and they do well moving forward. Now, there are still a percentage of babies that are born not knowing that their child's congenital heart disease. Those babies are born, typically, those babies present in one of four ways. They either have a situation where they present in shock, meaning that they have lack of blood flow going to their body. They present being really blue, what we call cyanosis, where the skin looks blue, the lips look blue. They can present with an abnormal heart rhythm, or they can present with a heart murmur. Now, a heart murmur is just a vibration that we can hear with a stethoscope, putting that on your baby's chest. And we hear the abnormal blood flow through the heart, and it manifests as a vibration that we call a murmur. So those babies that are born after, you know, that are diagnosed after birth typically present one of those four ways. And then you'll have a pediatric cardiologist come chat with you. They'll describe to you what the issue is. And then similarly, you'll then talk with a team about what comes next. And if it's a surgical situation, obviously a surgeon, a cardiothoracic surgeon specializes in taking care of babies with congenital heart disease, will be intimately involved in that discussion with a pediatric cardiologist to make a determination about what surgeries are required. Now, there are a small percentage of people that actually, they won't know that they have congenital heart disease till literally school age or even young adulthood, may not have been appreciated by the pediatrician, and something may occur where a murmur is picked up, and then ultimately, they determine that you have this congenital heart defect and that you have to go ahead and get appropriate assessment by a pediatric cardiologist or an adult congenital cardiologist, and then get the appropriate care. I think one of the key things people understand is that we don't think about pediatric cardiovascular disease in isolation. Patients now with pediatric congenital heart disease will survive, the vast majority of them, into adulthood. And now there's an entire new group of physicians called adult congenital heart disease physicians that care for these patients from literally fetal life all the way through, geriatric life in this congenital heart space. I think as a parent, when you start thinking about where do you want to get your care, you want a center that literally, can take care of your child literally from cradle to cane, from, fetal life and birth all the way to adult care. There are great programs nationally, and they all have a different structure. Some of them are freestanding children's hospitals without adult care. Some of them, like Cleveland Clinic, are fully integrated medical systems. We're very blessed here at Cleveland Clinic. We have the number one adult cardiovascular program in the country for the last 26 years, our Heart Vascular Thoracic Institute, as well as having one of the best pediatric cardiac programs in the country. And you want to go to a program that can offer care for your child, not just as a fetus or an infant, but all the way through adulthood. And that transition of care during adolescence and young adulthood is very critical. A lot of patients get lost to care there. So if you're in an integrated medical system like with Cleveland Clinic, you just stay within the Cleveland Clinic, and we just get you a new doctor to add to your care team as a young adult to then take on your adult congenital heart care needs.
Wonderful. So I'm wondering, you already touched on this a little bit as you were talking, but as you're moving throughout your life, as these patients with congenital heart disease are moving throughout their entire life, what kind of treatment options generally are they going to experience?
So if your child is born either diagnosed in fetal life or right after birth with a very complex congenital heart defect, your child's likely to need either a cardiac catheterization procedure or a surgery. And those surgeries, today in our current era, across the country, 97% of the individuals that have congenital heart surgery will survive within at least 30 days after their operation. But this is extraordinary. In a generation, we've gone from over 30% mortality rate, meaning if you had a congenital heart surgery, you had a 1 out of 3 chance of dying, to now where it's literally 97% survivable. And at the best centers, like here at Cleveland Clinic, our actual mortality rate or likelihood of death is less than 1%. So more than 99% of the patients that we'll take care of here at Cleveland Clinic will actually survive their initial operation. So if you need surgery, make sure you're getting it at a center that has a very, very, very low death rate, and more importantly, has very few complications. And then this data is available to most families when they're making these very, very important decisions for their infants, for their fetuses. Now, if you don't need surgery when you're first born, you may need surgery later on in childhood or as an adult congenital patient. And I think at that point, it's very, very important that you get the right follow-up care and that you're at a place that can make the right decisions about recommendations to you as the patient or the parent as to what you may want to do for your child. Here at Cleveland Clinic, every Monday, our entire team of more than 75 professionals, cardiologists, advanced practice providers, surgeons, anesthesiologists, nursing leaders, we get together every week and discuss literally dozens of patients to make sure that as a team, we're giving parents the critical information they need to make the appropriate decisions for their children. You want to make sure you get a broad-based opinion from a leading center when you're making these critical decisions about, your child's care. Whether they be a baby or whether they be a child, adult, congenital patient, experience matters and outcomes matter. Frankly, reputation is great. A brand is important, but all that matters really is, can they assess your child appropriately? Can they give you the options thoughtfully in a way that you can understand them and then allow you to make the appropriate decision for your family and then support you in those decisions to take the best care of your child?
Yeah, it's absolutely a stressful time for many parents when they hear those words together. So it's good to have a team that they can feel comfortable with. Now, you mentioned earlier about how people can have this condition for a long period of time without even knowing it into adulthood. Can it go away on its own sometimes?
So things like a small ventricular septal defect, which is again a hole between two pumping chambers, if it's what we call a muscular ventricular septal defect, upwards of 75% of those holes will actually close in the first several years of life. Patients with atrial septal defects, if they're small, they may also close in the first several years of life. Patent duct arteriosus, which is the connection between the aorta and the pulmonary artery, which is normally open in utero, but then closes in the first several weeks of life, that may close over the first months to a year or so if it is not closed right away after birth. Other than those three defects, pretty much everything else is something you're going to have moving forward in your life. Now, it may be that it doesn't progress or change. So for example, you could have some mild narrowing of the pulmonary valve. And you can live with that your entire life and never have anything done and just follow up with a cardiologist every 2 or 3 years just to take a look and make sure it's not changing. You could have a situation where you have aortic valve stenosis, minimal amount of stenosis that doesn't change for decades. And then you may not need something done until your fourth, fifth, sixth decade potentially, and everything in between. So I think the key piece to this is whatever the diagnosis is of congenital heart disease, unless it's a patent duct arteriosus, atrial septal defect, or ventricular septal defect, that closes, you're going to need long-term follow-up. And getting the right pediatric cardiologist and team around them, and it's obviously a surgical patient, right? Pediatric cardiac surgical team. To support your child is critically important. I think the other thing that we haven't touched on yet, which is really important, is that we know that half of our children that survive congenital heart surgery will have specific neurodevelopmental, psychosocial, behavioral, emotional issues that relate to white matter injury or brain injury that occurred during fetal life and then with the first operation as a newborn. We know that babies with congenital heart disease will often have decreased brain growth in the third trimester. And that when babies with congenital heart disease are born with those with severe congenital heart disease, the brains are literally the size of a 35-week preemie. We know the brains are less developed. We know that at birth, one-third of these babies with complex congenital heart disease will actually have what we would call periventricular leukomalacia, which is basically loss of white matter, which are the wires that connect the thinking parts of the brain. Remember from high school biology, there's the gray matter, the outside of your brain, which is the thinking part of your brain. And then there's the inside, the white matter, which connects all the gray matter and basically does all the talking between the different thinking centers of your brain. If your brain is immature and you have potential damage to that wired connection, and then you go on cardiac pulmonary bypass, we know that that impacts the brain in a very specific way as well. One-third of the children after going on cardiac pulmonary bypass will have new white matter injury. We also know that the inflammation that the brain undergoes from being on the cardiac pulmonary bypass machine results in the actual brain cells themselves not proliferating or growing in that first year of life like it normally would, which results in what we call decreased connectivity. So again, if you think of your brain as being a computer, There are parts of your computer that are thinking parts of your computer, and there are parts of your computer that are basically wires. If the thinking parts of your computer are not connected effectively, that computer doesn't work as well as it might. It's not going to be as efficient. So we know that in half the kids that have newborn or infant in the first year of life, congenital heart surgery on the heart-lung machine, cardiac pulmonary bypass, that they will have a specific phenotype or specific set of potential issues that we as cardiologists and cardiac neurodevelopmental specialists will treat. They will often have issues with what we call executive functioning, where the ability to make decisions and do high complex operations or procedures or to follow a multi-step process may not go as well. Maybe issues with that. And that doesn't typically manifest itself in elementary school where teachers pretty much organize their kids on a daily basis. It will definitely show up in middle school and for sure in high school. We know that kids who had heart surgery in the first year of life on the heart-lung machine are more likely to have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which many parents are familiar with. There may be issues with processing speed in terms of how quickly you can think and then process information. There may be issues with what we call working memory. So if you think about your computer, everyone's heard of RAM or random access memory. RAM is about how many processes or programs you have open at one time on your computer. So if you have issues with working memory, it's harder for you to have four or five things that you're thinking about at the same time and utilizing to do your tasks. We know that these kids will have fine motor issues because of the white matter injury, some of them some gross motor issues in terms of the white matter injury. And then importantly, I think parents often ask this question, from an intelligence quotient, from an IQ standpoint, the majority of children with congenital heart disease will be normal. The majority of them will also have a normal math and language academic achievement in school. But many of the parents remember from high school, when you took your statistics course or your math course, we talk about a normal distribution in the population. In a normal population, 2.5% are low, 2.5% are high, let's say IQ, and then 95% normal in the middle. In kids with congenital heart disease, it's actually that curve, which normally looks like this, is shifted to the left. So that now instead of 2.5% being low, it's actually 30% or low. Now 70% are still normal or high, but 10 times more patients will be low than in the normal population for both IQ and math and language achievement. We know that there are psychosocial issues that arise from this brain injury that these babies suffer both in fetal life and in utero, and then after their cardiac surgery. And there's a much higher incidence of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress in both the child and the family. There can be issues with coping in the child, with family functioning. We know the parents, as you said earlier, Molly, very stressful time for them. Raising a child with a chronic disease that requires medications and requires lots of doctor visits can be very stressful for these parents as well. So all these factors occur in about half of the patients that we see. And as a result, we have set up here at Cleveland Clinic, and there are now many of them across the country, specific cardiac neurodevelopmental follow-up programs to basically bring children in as infants and then in toddlerhood, school age, and evaluate them to see what are the specific neuropsychological or psychosocial or behavioral emotional issues that these kids may face, and then figure out specifically how can we support these families to allow them to have the children reach their highest potential in school, educationally, and obviously thrive socially and within the context of their family.
So there can be a long-term impact to this. It's not just a have a procedure and it's all done and all gone.
Yeah, Molly, that's really been what we've all learned in our field in the last two decades. When I was a cardiology fellow in the 1990s, I literally used to walk into family and say, we're going to take your child to the OR, we're going to fix them, and everything's going to be fine. And we didn't know then that actually that wasn't true, that in half of these children, that they were going to have this white matter injury that would have an impact on them from a neuropsychological as well as from a psychosocial, behavioral, emotional standpoint. It's been what I call the grand re-education of healthcare providers, both general pediatricians, family practice docs, internists, pediatric cardiologists over the last 20 years, educating them that if you have congenital heart disease, which is the most common birth defect, and you have surgery, that there is a possibility that there's going to be some longstanding issues from a brain standpoint that we want to make you aware of, and that you need to refer to us for evaluation and management. This came to a head in 2012 when the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Heart Association published the first guideline on the evaluation management of these neurodevelopmental psychosocial issues in kids with congenital heart disease as a major scientific statement. Since that time in 2012, a group called the Cardiac Neurodevelopmental Outcome Collaborative was formed, which has more than 45 participating institutions in the United States, Canada, and Europe to basically come together to figure out how we're going to best prevent brain injury. And if a child has brain injury with congenital heart disease, how do we treat that moving forward over the first two decades of childhood, obviously, and then ultimately into the adult congenital heart disease period when they're adults. Both from a research standpoint, clinical standpoint, and quality standpoint, this group is now collecting data internationally and is already starting to put out some of the seminal research in this area. So, the field has changed dramatically in the last two decades, and I'm very, very excited and proud of where we've come to, but there's so much more work to do. And, what I would say to parents are, we are completely committed both here at Cleveland Clinic and around, the United States, to figure out how we prevent brain injury in kids with congenital heart disease and then treat it most effectively so that these children can not just survive, but thrive.
Now, as you're having these conversations with parents about long-term side effects and the impact over time, are there any physical limitations like involving sports or physical activities that you recommend to parents?
Again, it depends on what the specific congenital heart defect is. There are certain types of congenital heart defects that may require certain therapies that we would say, you can't play football and do contact sports. You can't go on a roller coaster. There are many of them we say you can. A lot of it depends on over time with the structural abnormalities to the heart, does that result in the heart muscle itself, the left ventricle, having issues? Because if a child then develops heart failure, secondarily to having congenital heart disease, that will specifically change again what we recommend for that child or that parent. Many children with congenital heart disease will need what we call bacterial endocarditis prophylaxis at the dentist. Those recommendations have changed over the last 10 years, and now much fewer of our patients require that. But if your child has congenital heart disease, definitely ask your pediatric cardiologist whether your child needs bacterial endocarditis prophylaxis. Bacterial endocarditis is when you have a bacteria that can get into your blood and then basically attach itself to your heart or the heart vessels and create an infection. But as far as limitations to the specific physical activity a child might want to do, it's highly variable. Now, what I will say is this, pretty much all children are not going to be Olympic athletes. The vast majority of children are actually not going to be college athletes. A few of them will be high school athletes. The vast majority of kids play recreational sports. I think for most pediatric cardiologists, with rare exception, child can self-limit and they can tell you when they need to take a break if they have congenital heart disease. Most cardiologists will let them participate in those types of activities without any limitations. So again, ultimately, it's always whatever the specific defect is that your child has, speak to your pediatric cardiologist. They will specifically let you know what your child can and can't do. But for the vast majority of the patients we take care of, community-based, non-competitive sports, I'll say, are completely appropriate and highly encouraged by the pediatric cardiology community.
And as a child is out there doing activities and, getting moving, what are some signs that a parent should keep an eye for, especially if they already have a diagnosis of congenital heart defect?
So I just want to reiterate that if a child is having issues, they will self-limit. So it's very, very likely that if your child's a congenital heart defect, if they're having issues, they will tell you, and they will tell you early and often. If that's not the case, if they are breathing much harder, if you feel their pulse and they've got a much higher pulse rate than normal that is sustained after activity is completed, if they have chest pain at peak exercise, if obviously they pass out, you know, these are signs that you want to have your child evaluated, you know, immediately by either their pediatric cardiologist or pediatrician or emergency department. When in doubt, take them in for evaluation. Don't wait. You know, don't hesitate. If your child has congenital heart disease and you think there's a problem, take them in for evaluation.
This is rewinding a little bit back to before a child is born, but is there any way a parent can prevent a congenital heart defect, or is it kind of just so wrapped up in genetics, there's no way to prevent this?
Yeah, I mean, so there's still obviously a lot that we don't know about what causes congenital heart disease. In terms of what we currently know today, getting the best prenatal care you can from, you know, an appropriate obstetrical practice is really the best way to prevent all congenital defects, not just congenital heart disease. You know, there are obviously, as we talked about before, certain medications that are associated with congenital heart defects. And usually if that's the case, the mother would have had to have been on those specifically. And if the child is potentially going to get a congenital heart defect from that medication, typically the obstetrician will talk with that parent, that mother and father, about the fact you need to be on this medication, but you can take this medication. There is this potential risk for this specific type of congenital heart disease. And the parent obviously has to make that call as to whether they want to take that medication or not. But other than not taking a specific medication that may be associated with congenital heart disease, there's really not much that a mother and father can do other than just get the appropriate, you know, prenatal care. You know, the genetics are the genetics. There are some lesions that specifically we know are hereditary and, you know, can be passed along in families, specifically of the left side of the heart. But short of that, not taking medication that may be associated with congenital heart defects and getting good prenatal care, there's really not much that a parent can do to prevent it.
Now, if you have a child in your family who has a congenital heart defect, and you find that you are pregnant a second time, should you have any extra tests done or have any extra concerns?
So I want to reassure the parents that are watching this, that even if your child does have congenital heart disease, the actual risk of the second child having congenital heart disease, while it is higher than the pregnancy where there isn't a child with congenital heart disease in that family, it is not significantly high. So, you know, if you have now that second pregnancy and your first child had congenital heart disease, the vast majority of obstetricians I know will make sure that child, the second child, specifically gets a fetal echocardiogram just to make sure that there's not, you know, congenital heart disease again in the second child. Now, there are families where I've seen multiple children in the same family have congenital heart disease, but it's not always the same congenital heart defect. It may be a much more mild version of it, or maybe a more complex version of it, but that's usually pretty rare. I will say in the vast majority of families where I've seen a child with congenital heart disease, they will have multiple children after that that don't have congenital heart defects. So, you know, I think the most important thing is if you're a parent that has a child with congenital heart disease, when you get pregnant that second time, make sure that you talk with your obstetrician, get a fetal echocardiogram done so that you can have some peace of mind and hopefully that child, which is most likely, won't have a congenital heart defect as well.
So wrapping up here today, I just am hoping you could give our listeners a few tips on how to talk to kids about congenital heart defects and what kind of talking points parents should work into the conversation.
Mom, it's such an important point. I'm glad that we're kind of finishing the conversation this way. You know, we really struggled a generation ago to have the vast majority of these kids survive. And we're there now. With a, you know, 97% plus survival rate for the vast majority of the kids that have heart surgery now, if you have congenital heart disease, the high likelihood is that you will survive into adulthood. We then, over the last 20 years, have really now delved into what the specific complications or what the issues that may arise from either having the congenital heart disease is or getting treatment for it. And, you know, I think we really, really worked very hard to kind of educate our communities and our families over the last 10 years about that. But I think really in the next 10 years, it's all about telling these kids with congenital heart disease that even though you have congenital heart defect, there's really nothing that you can't do. And building that resilience to make them understand that while they have this congenital heart defect, it does not determine their life. It's not to determine who they are, who they can be, what they can do in their lives. You know, there are many patients with congenital heart disease, individuals that are incredibly successful doctors, lawyers, business people. So there really is no limit to what anyone with congenital heart disease can accomplish in their lifetime. Most importantly, if you get the right care, if you have the right team surrounding you and your child, help guide you through that several decade long process through childhood, adolescence, into adulthood, and then have your child transition to the right adult congenital care, as long as they're getting the right medical care in the background with their family practitioner, internist, pediatrician, within that medical home, you know, your child can do anything. So, you know, I don't think really at this point there's any limitations to what we can now do as a community to support these children and these families. And I'm humbled, frankly, over the last 20 years to see how far we've come as a field and how well all these children are doing now. So if your child's congenital heart disease, it doesn't mean anything other than get the right assessments, get the right team around you and your child. We will help you make sure that they're physically well, or as well as they can be. And then as a parent, treat them like a normal child. Listen to your cardiologist relative to any limitations that they may put on them for physical activities, which frankly shouldn't be many in most cases, but again, listen to your cardiologist. And then the rest is just up to you as a parent. You know, your children, they always see themselves through your eyes. If you see them as, you know, this amazing miracle who is going to impact the world in a positive way and is going to be highly successful, that's who they're going to be. So again, our goal is here to work with parents, make sure kids survive and thrive. And, you know, here at Cleveland Clinic, we're here to help every child do that.
Thank you so much for talking to us today and sharing your insights, Dr. Marino.
Thanks, Molly. I really appreciate the time.
To learn more about heart conditions and heart health, visit clevelandclinicchildrens.org/cardiology.
Thank you for listening to Health Essentials, brought to you by Cleveland Clinic and Cleveland Clinic Children's. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit clevelandclinic.org/HEpodcast. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the latest health tips, news, and information.